You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
He not only gave us right insight on China, Iran, and Russia, and I'm sure he's got some information about Area 51 up his sleeve. He also gave us the tactical diaper bag. So joining us is Alex Hollings. Alex, what's up?
Hey, man, how's it going?
That's a fair amount of diversity in one human being.
I tell you what, I try my best to stay interesting. You know, but in this line of work, the best thing that I can do is just read enough about enough different things that I've got something to offer, regardless of what the topic of conversation is. Right?
You've never struggled, as far as I can recall.
Well, that's how I think you find yourself in writing, is that eventually you have so much to say and people are so sick of listening to you that you just got to sit down and write it. And I hope somebody else will listen to you later. Right.
The, all right, now, I had a question for you about, before we talk about gear, all right, and, so we always talk about gear. Alex comes on, he's now the head man at the Loadout Room. You can find it at theloadoutroom.com or loadoutroom.com, I can never remember.
Loadoutroom.com, you got it.
All right, so before we talk about that, what do you think of this idea? I know you're like a it's not even a closet event. You're like a space geek, okay? What about the idea of storming Area 51?
Oh, I've got so much to say about this. I've been waiting for someone to ask me. Well, first of all, let's all be honest with each other.
Okay.
The entire premise of this storming Area 51 has always been and still is a joke, right? Anybody who takes it seriously is a fool, okay?
What?
Now, with that said, I know a guy who worked security at this facility, which obviously in the government, in the military, you don't call Area 51. It's a part of the Nellis Range, which is the same huge expanse of military-controlled territory that Nellis Air Force Base is on,
right,
and a number of other installations.
Right.
It's in the Groom Lake dry bed, and the reason why it got the name Area 51 was because long ago, when this whole area was being used for atomic test sites, they had divided the entire region up into areas. So then, when somebody stumbled across this government installation that wasn't listed on the map, the map that they had on hand was an old, dated map going back to during this testing time frame, and they marked the spot in the middle of an area that's called Area 51 as per those nuclear delineation lines, right? And that's where we get the name Area 51. The base is not actually called that. There is an official name for it that I've heard a couple different ones tossed around. I'm sure it's something really lame.
I know.
You know? But the truth of the matter is that this facility is where some of the absolute coolest aircraft we have ever had has been tested. And I don't just mean cool aircraft that we've developed. Area 51 has also been where we've brought stolen or otherwise acquired enemy aircraft for the purposes of reverse engineering, studying for flaws, and actually doing aggressor operations against our best aircraft, you know what I mean? We stole some MiGs in the past, and then we brought in all of our best air intercept fighters, our F-14s, F-15s, and had them go against these stolen aircraft so that we could get a real solid understanding of how best to combat, you know, Soviet jets.
Why this range in Nevada? Simply because there was nobody around?
It really is. It's partially because it is so far removed from anything, and partially because the U.S. government controls such a vast expanse of territory out there without anybody really having any issue with it, because what else are you going to do with it? So, for instance, just recently, pictures of F-117, just one, feasibly, F-117, were spotted flying around the areas near Area 51 that were still part of the Nellis Range, expanding all the way out towards California.
Whoa.
And people are like, oh, what's going on with these F-117s? My belief is that they're actually using them as aggressor aircraft. They're using them to train our pilots to learn how to attack and pursue stealth aircraft, the likes of which we may see from Russia and China, especially because the F-117 stealth is probably fairly comparable to what we're getting out of Russia and China right
well,
now.
Well, since they based all their shit on our plans that they stole, and I would
they
think.
Did, you know, although, but they can't they can't duplicate our production processes. That's really where the
well,
magic lies in stealth.
The alcohol, and, hey, the alcohol in the Soviet, the former Soviet Union, has it comes to roost someplace.
Exactly,
and,
right?
And often it is. I mean, well, I mean, the Russians have issues with. I mean, and we just saw a submarine. You know, they lose how many 20-something people on a submarine that couldn't get to the surface.
You know, and this is not a new development for
right.
Russia.
And
you
it,
know,
it happens,
I mean, losing
yeah.
guys in submarines that they're being sneaky about isn't new, but also just building halfway decent, which is also halfway crappy. Military technology, boasting that it is incredible and then watching it fail is kind of a Russian tradition, you know?
Yeah.
I'm writing an article right now about their T-80 battle tank that was supposed to be the best tank
oh
in the world.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know, and then 1994, you know, they lost 100 tanks and 1,000, or 200 tanks and 1,000 troops to Chechenian rebels in the span of weeks because the tanks ran out of gas and weren't very well protected, you know? So this is it's a common trend for Russia. However, Russia does have a history of making pretty good aircraft. I do not think, however, that the Su-57 is among them. It's a piece of crap. But to get back to Area 51,
let me ask you a question. You could write a lot of great gear reviews, but if you wrote a really good piece about Area 51 and folded in a little bit of fiction in there, you could make that go a long way, couldn't you?
I'm working on a piece right now that's going to be an article and a video that's going to be my recommended loadout for raiding Area 51.
Hey, I have a guy who comes on, Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenney come on the program. And so we're having a discussion about the drone that got shot down by the Iranians. And Lynch decides to write an article based on a hypothesis that this thing had run its course, right, and through testing.
Yep.
So they fitted it out, and then they intentionally violated Iranian airspace so they could get them to light off their weapons radar,
well,
right?
It was an excellent intelligence gathering opportunity.
Okay.
Right.
Right. And again, and I, to which I said, bro, we're really good at that. We probably know more about their system than they know.
I'm inclined to agree with you on this.
Okay. So, but he doubled down on me. So he then developed one more piece of the theory that sent this thing into hyperspace. He said, yeah. A week later he comes back, he goes, you know, Mac, I thought about that. Here's what I think. I think we did that so that we could plant a virus into through their radar electronic systems. Right? We can
no,
plant.
See, this is a great example right. of, like, I like this idea.
I know,
than
you know
what?
That's why I'm talking about it. Because, now, I said, now, is that even possible? He's like, I don't know. but do you think that will slow down the cyber activity of this thing? And Soldier of Fortune picked it up, and it's got a bazillion hits on it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the power of this kind of stuff.
And this is what it comes down, honestly, and Lord knows, I want to be clear right off the bat, I don't know that he's wrong, but I don't necessarily buy it, although I do think it's an awesome idea.
Doesn't it? Yeah, I'm like, whoa!
I love this idea.
If we could do that, if we could transmit, right, some kind of computer virus through the electronics
through
of
radar.
A radar beam.
Now, I'll tell you the reason why that would be really valuable in places other than Iran. The
yeah.
reason why we can't really affect North Korea's nuclear program via cyber attack is because it's air-gapped.
Wait, hold on. We didn't used to be able to affect.
Oh, but now.
Now! Thank you.
If we're using radar-borne viruses, we very feasibly could, because I'd imagine these missile apparatus, you know, the systems that they use to launch the missiles, I would imagine, do have radar so that
you
can check to see whether or not there's any aircraft.
And we don't
call,
we don't refer to them as radar-borne viruses. We refer to them as RBVs.
RBVs. These RBVs. I love the idea of RBVs. You know, I genuinely do.
Oh, my God.
The problem is with a lot of these conspiracies is that you have to operate under the assumption that the story's not going to get out. Now, here's the thing. China very recently revealed to the American public on our behalf that the U.S. Navy has been working on a Sea Dragon, potentially hypersonic, anti-ship missile for a long time now that's been deeply classified. China went ahead and accessed this information by hacking into defense contractors like GE, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and revealed all this through their own press. And then we ended up covering our own defense initiatives, sourcing Chinese websites that had gotten the information from Chinese intelligence services that had stolen it from us. The chances that we have got RBVs that we haven't heard about either through our own leaks or through OCONUS leaks, I find pretty unlikely.
OCONUS, explain OCONUS.
OCONUS versus CONUS being Continental United States, which is a common phrase we use for just internally, versus OCONUS, like when you're on active duty, you'd say, I was stationed OCONUS, means outside the continental United States.
Yeah, not, OCONUS is not some Irish dude, okay?
Yeah, exactly. It's like anywhere that's not within the United States as you see it on a map, barring Hawaii and Alaska, because they're not considered continental United States. But when we tend to use the term talking about in the NATSEC circles, we kind of just, I guess, disregard Hawaii and Alaska and say OCONUS versus CONUS, meaning internal or external to the U.S., right?
All right, there you go. Footnoted.
So basically, the problem that I have with the idea of us using this like really advanced technology in rather low-stakes circumstances, like, for instance, sending a drone into Iranian airspace for intelligence gathering, which I buy that more than planting a virus. The reason why I find it less likely is because, number one, we don't have a ton of these multi-hundred-of-million-dollar drones laying around. And despite the fact that maybe it already served its purpose as a testbed, we can come up with new purposes for these aircraft every week. You know, that's the purpose of having platforms like this. You know, the F-117 is a great example. The F-117 only carries two weapons, you know, but over the years we developed new ways to make it more effective until it retired. We're still doing that with the B-1B Lancer. It's old, dated technology. You could feasibly say it's already served its purpose. But then we added a sniper pod to it, just like you'll find on an F-16. And all of a sudden, it's marginally effective as a close air support aircraft. We don't just throw planes away, especially ones that cost $200 million and are pretty advanced technology, for the purposes of intelligence gathering very often.
Okay, just quit shitting on the premise of a viral, of a borderline viral.
And I want to be clear here that I love this idea. So I'm like, unfortunately, this is my Debbie Downer part of my brain. I think that if we were capable of doing things like that, we would find far more effective means of doing it.
Okay,
need to let them shoot an aircraft down for us to use an RBV if we have them. if it's a radar-borne virus, they don't need to blow anything up for that to work.
Yeah. Question. What was the Air Force's response back to the original question about a quarter million people, right, storming the fences of Area 51?
This is the best part about when you talk about the Air Force's response. So the Air Force's response came from a public affairs officer, right? Which means that some guy, some poor dude, whose job is to serve as the spokesperson for this branch of the military to the media, had to address the fact that a bunch of assholes on the internet are saying they're going to storm a government facility. Right? So obviously he had to be like, okay, listen, we stand ready. You know,
but we stand ready.
But I also, you know, the I think the quote was like, the Air Force always stands ready to protect America and its assets, or something along those lines. I can't help but feel like he was smiling when he said it. I haven't seen video of him giving the quote, but anybody out there who has been reading the memes, I'm pretty sure that this was all born on a subreddit called Dank Memes, which gives you everything you need to know about its credibility right off the bat. If you're genuinely thinking it's a good idea to go storm Area 51, I highly recommend, one, that you start drinking water now, because your fat couch potato ass is going to go down in like 300 yards out in the deserts of Nevada. All right?
Yeah, especially during this time of year, bro. You know, might want to like reschedule this in November or January.
I was stationed in 29 Palms for a long time, and I have to tell you, Marines that are stationed in 29 Palms go down in right up through September as heat casualties. All the time.
So, all right. So if you think you're in your brand new running shoes, which will get destroyed in about 200 meters, and your cargo and your new cargo pants with a bush cover on,
your beard is only going to make things worse. Trust me.
You're going to be a mess. They won't even be ambulatory wounded. They'll be down hard. Man down. They'll be littered. What percentage?
Like farming silver bullets. There will just be guys face down with thermometers sticking out of their asses as far as the eye can see.
What percentage of the 250,000 do you think would finally rally on the objective?
Okay, so how many do you think would actually come, or how many do you think would make it all the way there?
Let's just assume, for the sake of discussion, that a 250,000 showed up. How many of that 250,000 do you think would get to the objective?
I think absolutely none. I think absolutely none of that. And I'll tell you why for a number of reasons. The first one being that just people. Now, this is assuming that they're not coming heavily armed, ready to go to war with the United States, right? These are just people. Just people can be stopped by pretty simple things, like a lock on a door. A barrier made out of concrete could stop a crowd of people pretty effectively, at least for a period of time. If the United States government had to use lethal force, I'm sure that they've got the means to do so, but I really doubt they even would. Maybe with 250,000, we'd consider it. If 250,000 people came, they'd probably just fly away and whatever they wanted to keep secret and open the doors. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that they all came. Those 250,000 people could be stopped pretty effectively with a series of non-lethal intervention tactics, you know? 250,000 is a lot, though. 250,000 is enough people that you can mush meat through the cracks of doors and get somebody inside.
Okay, so non-lethal means we could do a show of force, which is fly at relatively low level. We could fly a couple jets. That would ward off a fair number. They get closer, right? We drop a little CS.
I was going to say, dropping some ordnance.
Okay, now, if you've ever seen CS in the hot desert, where your pores are opened up,
and again, we're not talking about 250,000 people who've been through boot camp. We're talking about 250,000 internet warriors. When the CS starts popping open, they are not going to interpret that as something that you can manage. You'll see as many of them killing each other, trying to get out of the gas.
Yeah, running up the back of the guy or woman in front of them, right? And, and so this thing's going to buckle at that point right there, okay?
And, I mean, again, dropping some ordnance between the crowd and the base would definitely serve as a powerful deterrent. But the U.S. government also has a number of non-lethal weapons that use sound, for instance.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Oh, that. And now, I haven't actually experienced these firsthand. I've spoken to some people who have. And
Can you imagine the disability claims that would go in on that son of a bitch?
Now, I wonder, can you make a disability claim against the government if you're trying to storm a classified
government? Of course you can. What are you, stupid?
Of course you can.
Look, if you can call being deported after your asylum case has gone through the court system and the asylum judge says, yeah, that ain't asylum, and you've run afoul of the law, okay, if you can get the whole nation stirred up to say that you're being wronged and the immigration people aren't enforcing a deportation order. They're conducting a raid to throw you out of the country. If you can sell that one, you can sell anything.
You know, you make a reasonable point. You really do. You really do. But, at the end of the day, let's just say that the U.S. military needed to use lethal force to keep this mass from storming Area 51.
Come on.
It would not take much. Like, let's be honest, it would take three Apache gunships, and the whole crowd would disperse.
Well, they wouldn't even have to shoot either. They just have to, like, loiter in a menacing manner. Like, just do a little flyby. What do we have out there? The A-10, maybe?
Cops are getting thrown out of Starbucks because we're intimidated by a man in a uniform. I really don't think that this crowd of internet cowboys is going to do very well in this. But again, real life, let's say real life circumstances, this were going to happen.
Yes.
I think the U.S. government would just walk away from Area 51. They're not going to kill 250,000. They won't kill a quarter million American citizens.
Well, worse than trying to kill a quarter million Americans is the people that would die unintentionally, right? Because they were... You know, and I agree with you. They
even if the military were used entirely non-lethal means to dissuade this raid, a lot of people would die.
Yes, on their own they would die.
Not just that, but I mean, talk about Woodstock and Edgefest and these large festivals where you put 10,000 people in a field and there's six rapes that go on every day. So you take these 250,000
people. Come on, let's not get too much real life. Let's not get too much real life into this, okay?
This is what I'm saying. Nothing about this is going to happen. However, there is a possibility that I think is exciting and interesting that you will see a large crowd of American citizens gathering as close to Area 51 as they can safely gather, and it'll be a hell of a lot of fun for a couple of days while the news covers it like it's a real thing, and we all pretend that it matters. The truth of the matter is, I would be willing to bet, let's just say for the sake of argument, grain of salt here, that the government has UFO technology, right? The government's already captured a UFO in Roswell. For some reason, they reverse engineered all this technology, and they haven't seen fit to use it in any of the wars we can't seem to win, because they really want to sit on it and save it for World War III instead.
All right, here's an email. Fuck Starbucks. You two morons, I'll give you the solution to this. Get a few fire hoses out there. That'll do it. Nobody's going any further.
We're talking about Nevada, man. That water's expensive. Bullets are cheaper.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. It's tough to get those, you'd have to, like, organize the fire hose defense along, along a road, which they would be trying to get to just to get the fuck out of the base.
Nothing about this is feasible from any angle. But it is, I do think, genuinely, if the government's got UFO technology, it isn't there. There are video games and TV shows called Area 51, folks. There are websites devoted to this place. There are guys who camp on mountain ridges nearby every night, taking pictures of what aircraft take off and land near there. This is the reason why we knew the day an F-117 was flying around Area 51. Pictures were on Twitter. All right? So, let's say the government's got alien technology. They're not going to keep it in the super secret base that they're happy to tell you they have. All right? And
where do you think they would keep it?
I think that they would keep it probably much more in plain sight and just not outside. Okay? So if you're reverse engineering alien technology, there are, number one, for those who believe in these conspiracy theories in the tinfoil corners of the internet here.
You love this shit, though.
Oh, I know.
Wait, let me ask you this. How did you become, like, inculcated into this, and
This is actually how I got introduced to journalism, believe it or not. When I was a kid, I was in this, so I went to school for a short time there in Torrington, Connecticut, and in their junior high, they had this program called Talented and Gifted, which is for nerds, right?
The tag program?
The tag program, exactly. I don't know if this is nationwide or if it was just local, but, so the tag program, Talented and Gifted. So I was in this program at a young age. And the premise was you conduct a long-term research project instead of going to class sometimes. Like, effectively, you could get out of some English classes and some math classes to go do an independent research project on your own where you had an advisor. It was really a lot like the type of things you end up doing in college and in grad school. It was like an introduction to it, right? So while a lot of kids, you know, my first year doing it, I did it about, you know, baleen whales, like most kids, things like that. But my second year in the program, I really wanted to get kind of weird with it, and I decided to research aliens and UFOs. So I reached out to a man named Stanton Friedman, who anybody out there who's into UFOs immediately will recognize that name. He just passed away recently. He's one of those guys, one of the few guys that's taken really seriously in his investigative efforts about UFOs and aliens. He doesn't really buy into this whole, he doesn't opine when it comes to whether or not they're extraterrestrials or they're Chinese. He just pursues his investigation.
Well, hold on, let me ask you a question. What is an extraterrestrial?
Well, you know, extraterrestrial being anything that's not from Earth.
Okay.
Right? Right. So EBE is the term they used to use, extraterrestrial biological entity. You know, but the idea really was is that Stanton Friedman started out researching this stuff. He was I think he might have been a nuclear physicist once upon a time in his first job. At any rate, you know, he's a credentialed guy who takes the matter seriously. He's written a number of books, co-written many more. Some of the co-written books aren't quite as credible because his co-authors were kind of crackpots. But at any rate, this guy is a really well-respected dude in the UFO community. And seventh grade Alex Hollings wrote him a letter and called him on like his business line. And the guy took my call. Whoa. You know, not only did he take my call, but like a week later, I got a package in the mail with a bunch of declassified documents that he sent me copies of, photographs of that people had taken and sent to him of UFOs, his own notes and stuff like that. And he was like, here, you know, if you think this stuff will help you with your project, you know, I wanted to give you a copy of all of it. And I felt like a journalist with a press pass in my derby like I had seen on TV. Like I had these, here I am in seventh grade getting declassified documents sent to me in the mail. And it really, that I, you know, I did very well on that project as a result, and it pointed me in the direction that I ended up pursuing as a career. And it's all thanks to just being a nerd that really liked UFOs when I was a kid. So the UFOs actually predate the journalism for me, you know,
which is,
it's why I probably know more about this despite very little of it having any credibility.
So you started out as a dweeb kid doing
I was, this. By ninth grade, I had a map of the United States on my wall that I used to keep track of a number of things, one of them being UFO sightings, especially near me. I was very interested in the idea
so
that I might be able to see
have
one.
Have you ever had a UFO experience?
I don't think so. You know, I've definitely seen some weird things in the sky over the years, but yeah. I'd be willing to bet all the weird things I've seen in the sky over the years were military aircraft that were just tough to make out from where I was, you know. One time as a kid, I did see something really, like, fly really low over me that seemed super quiet, and at the time I ran inside certain that I had seen a UFO. But in hindsight, you know, a triangle of lights in the sky sounds an awful lot like an airplane. And it probably was just up higher and was bigger than I thought, you know? So I don't think I've ever seen a UFO. But I'd be willing to bet that 99% of people who say they have haven't either. I'm willing to allow for that 1%.
You're willing. How about the Navy pilots that say
that 1%.
That's the 1%?
Those Navy pilots, there was a B-1B Lancer pilot who made the shift to commercial airlines a few years ago who had another really pretty compelling sighting last year. There were sightings over Washington, D.C. in the 50s that I also think were really interesting because we scrambled aircraft to intercept them, you know, repeatedly over the span of a couple of weeks. Some of these things, there's enough evidence, and the evidence comes from reliable enough witnesses that I'm willing to admit that I don't know. But for the vast majority, I usually go, you know, it's one of those things where you say, you know, Occam's razor, right? The assertion that, or the solution that requires
assertions. What is Occam's razor?
That's you know, the solution that requires the fewest assertions, right, is one way to describe it. It's basically the simplest answer is often the correct one. That's not really a verbatim explanation of it, but it's the thing that requires the fewest deductive leaps is probably the one that's true, right? So if you see something unusual in the sky.
Hold on. Occam's razor, right?
Yep.
O-C-C-A-M apostrophe S razor or O-C-K-H-A-M razor is a principle from philosophy. Suppose there exists two explanations for an occurrence. In this case, the one that requires the least speculation is usually correct. Another way of saying it is that the more assumptions you have to make, the more unlikely the explanation. Occam's razor. Wow, I'm impressed, man. That's like legitimate intel. That's like, you're smart. That makes you smart today.
You know, and here I am talking about little green men. That's how it comes out, you know. But you know, I try my best to use Occam's razor in all of my work, whether we're talking about UFOs or foreign policy, right?
I have an Occam's razor built into me. It's called the bullshit meter, right?
Exactly.
Okay,
that's
if
exactly
this,
it.
Then this. Okay, sorry, that's too much, all right?
In the sky, and you go, okay, that light is acting weird. So what are the possibilities here? One possibility is that it's a military aircraft, that maybe it's even a military aircraft I've never heard of before, but more likely than not, if it's acting weird in the sky, it's probably a helicopter looking for something. The next assertion could be that it's a civilian aircraft that doesn't know what it's doing or is in distress. The next possibility that when you see a light in the sky is that it could be a meteor, right, or something similar to that. And then you keep going down this list, and then finally you get to this one where you're like, another species developed the capabilities for interstellar travel, traveled here, has managed to avoid detection for however long that they've stayed, and right now I'm the one that caught them. Now, that's not impossible. Certainly not. It is, however, a lot less likely than the rest of the list.
So if I get Occam's razor out, I hack that one off at the kneecaps, man.
More often than not. But then every once in a while, Commander Fravor shows up telling you that he was chasing an alien in his F-18.
Right.
He's got footage from his FLIR camera. And this dude's been to combat twice and knows how aircraft are supposed to operate.
Oh, my God.
This is nothing that he's ever seen before.
And what did the dorks wet themselves over that, yes?
Absolutely. And I would say rightfully so. Because when it comes to – so Foo Fighters are where the United States really first got introduced in large part to the idea of UFOs. Foo Fighters were in World War II. It was what our pilots and British pilots reported seeing these strange lights – that were flying in parallel to them, that seemed to be chasing them or playing cat and mouse games with them during World War II. That was really where it became prominent.
Wait. Foo Fighter?
Foo Fighters. That was what they called them. This was kind of before we started calling them flying saucers.
It's not a band?
Well, that's where the band gets their name.
Ah, I didn't know that.
So Foo Fighters were a really common
occurrence.
Hey,
can I tell you one other thing?
Hit me.
I binge-watched Carpool Karaoke over the weekend.
I haven't watched it yet. Oh, no, I have, with
John.
It's the late night guy,
yeah.
Right?
Let me tell you, that shit is hilarious. Okay?
Yeah, my wife and daughter absolutely love it.
Let me tell you, that dude, right, he always plays this guy like, I need to get to work. I got to get in the carpool lane. I need somebody else. And then he picks his cell phone, and you see him say, hey, mate, I'm trying to get to work. I'm not going to make it if I don't get in the carpool lane. Can you help me out? And then, like, into the car steps Elton John. Into the car steps Paul McCartney. And then they sing on the way, and then he talks to him.
Except for with Mariah Carey. But that's one episode I saw where she was just a total bitch.
Oh, no. I'll tell you what.
She barely
watch...
sang at all. She was, like, miserable to be there.
Oh, my God. Watch the one with Gwen Stefani. Hilarious. And she... and
Gwen Stefani and I have some things from the 90s I still need to work out with
really?
Her.
Really? Wow. Well, then she'd be one to work them out with. But let me tell you, I laughed my ass off watching him do this thing. Yeah. So I kind of
James Corden. That's his name. James Corden.
James
right?
Corden.
Yeah.
He's funny.
I like him.
And he likes to sing. But what's really cool is the people that get into it, and is they most of them. And I don't care if you watch the one with J Lo or Elton John. Or One Direction, or Michelle Obama, when at first they get in, and they're kind of like, and then they start singing and dancing in their seat like everybody does, right, when they drive. I'm telling you, if you're looking for a way to waste a few hours, I'd recommend that. That comes like three stars for me.
Because this gets to, like, I just yesterday, for the first time ever in my life, watched an episode of America's Got Talent.
Oh, really?
I hate these kinds of shows.
Yeah.
But, you know, my wife threw it on Hulu, and I was like, you know, whatever. There's nothing in here that's so offensive that my daughter can't put up with it, and she seems
right.
pretty cool, so let's watch it, right?
Right.
Honestly, I think that's kind of a cool concept for a show, just because it's positive. Overall, every once in a while, it's nice to just see something where it's like you can just like things. Like, there's no drama, nothing has to be negative. There's enough negativity in this world. I'm totally with you. Every once in a while, I just want to watch some dudes sing along.
Let me tell you, I crossed paths with Gwen Stefani on The Voice. I never really,
Well, see, now I have a newfound respect for these kinds. I never watched The Voice. I've never seen American Idol. I've never seen any of these shows. And after watching one episode of, and it was the first one that Terry Crews was hosting. I like Terry Crews. So I was like, you know what? I can actually get behind this.
Who's Terry Crews?
Big, huge Jax dude. He's on Brooklyn 9-1-1.
Yeah, okay. I know who he is. Here's what I liked about my daughters love those shows, okay? So, and they're music girls. My older daughter's was into singing, blah, 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 blah. The younger one thinks she can sing, but can't. But they love watching those shows, and I didn't particularly care for them. I didn't like the whole Simon Cowell shit on people in public things.
Exactly,
I never watched them.
I don't need that shit in my life.
Exactly, The Voice, they don't do that, and they take people and they pair them with like somebody like Miley Cyrus or Pharrell, and you get to see them work with the artist and then come back and sing the song. And it's really cool. I thought it was really cool to watch. I haven't watched it in over a year, but I used to watch it on a fairly regular basis with my daughter, and I enjoyed it. And that's where I saw Gwen Stefani, and Gwen Stefani is pretty easy on the eyes.
Yeah, she is still killing it. I mean, I might have loved her in No Doubt Days, but she's still killing it.
But let me tell you, she comes across as a nicer person than she is looking, which is a fairly rare commodity. Speaking of that, I've read a lot about Alex Rodriguez and Jennifer Lopez since we're doing pop culture right now. There was an article like last week or the week before said they were having problems. Jennifer Lopez stayed 12 innings at the baseball game last night waiting for Alex Rodriguez, okay? Now,
so if they are having problems, she's the problem then because she's trying to make something better.
Well, yeah,
exactly. I've never in my life sat through 12 innings of a baseball game.
In Fenway Park with her daughter, she sat and waited. So let me tell you.
The only way you get me through 12 innings of a baseball game is with the promise of Alex Rodriguez's money.
I thought you were going to say with the promise of Gwen Stefani actually speaking to me.
Yeah, I would do it for Gwen Stefani speaking to me too.
But that's how I saw Gwen Stefani. And then, so when I saw that she was one of the ones doing carpool karaoke, I watched that, which is really funny because she gets into it. And then in the middle of it, right, George Clooney and, actress Julia Roberts get in.
George Clooney, if we're going to do this pop culture thing, I'm at a disadvantage because I don't know much about pop culture. But I saw George Clooney recently, and it really bummed me out that, like everybody does it, where as you get older, one day you just kind of like cross over that barrier into being an old guy.
All
of a sudden you just look a little thinner, you look a little frailer. He just recently turned that corner. He's always been a salt and pepper dude, but he just recently started looking frail, and it's a real bummer for me. I love the Ocean's movies. You know, that's the George Clooney of always to me. So, like, when I see him now, like, looking like an old guy, it just reminds me of my own mortality and really bumps me out.
See? I need to see a recent picture of him.
I saw him recently. Maybe it was because, you know, his wife's a lot younger, and she's beautiful, of course.
Yeah,
but he looked like an old man all of a sudden, and I was just like,
there's a picture of him with her sitting on his lap watching fireworks.
She's sitting on his lap because he's in a wheelchair because he's 1,000 now. No, I'm just kidding. And maybe it was just a bad picture, but you know, there's a reason why I stick to my television from the early 90s.
Do you think there's a lot of pressure on George Clooney to be George Clooney? I mean, it's like
of course, absolutely. Have you seen what happened to Jason Momoa recently?
Who's
Aquaman, you know, and he's famous for, one, being Aquaman, and two, for every woman who's under 35.
Are you a Marvel Comics guy? You got it.
I am a big superhero nerd, yeah. And come on, we started this conversation on UFOs. You think superheroes wouldn't be in here, too, rattling around?
I was going to say.
On how Batman represents America's perception of itself.
So if you were to be a superhero, you'd be Batman?
Oh, I mean, if I got to pick, no, man. I mean, I wouldn't pick to be like the miserable, brooding guy with no powers and dead parents.
Right.
if I got to pick, I'd probably go with Superman or something like that.
Really?
But as far as superheroes that, like, I can...
I like Captain America.
Captain America is my favorite superhero, and has been for most of my life. Spider-Man for a short time as a kid, but Captain America was kind of always there. You know, I have a Captain America shield hanging up in my garage as we speak.
Oh, my God.
A full-size shield. I'm that kind of nerd.
A full-size shield? Not like
a
little
plastic,
kid?
It's plastic, though. It's not like a cool metal one. I've got all kinds of weird stuff, though. My wife.
Hold on. Email. Hey, Mac. Has Alex heard of Bob Lazar?
Of course I've heard
from
Bob
Area 51. Lazar was giving insight on that facility.
And now some things that Bob Lazar has said over the years have if you're not familiar with Bob Lazar, according to him, he worked at Area 51 and has become a whistleblower. And some of the things that he said over the years have genuinely come back to some extent or another as being verified. I think that there's a chance that there's some truth to the things that Bob Lazar says, but the problem with Bob Lazar is that he's become a mythical figure. Anybody who's familiar with the Mandela effect can tell you that...
Explain it.
So the Mandela effect, now we're getting pretty deep into YouTube conspiracy corner here, but the Mandela effect is basically this idea that we live in lots of different parallel universes and occasionally they accidentally intersect. The reason why it's called the Mandela effect is because it first rose to prominence with a lot of people believing that they genuinely recall Nelson Mandela passing away in the 1990s while he was still in prison. And so then when Nelson Mandela passed away a few years ago, all these people were like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Nelson Mandela died 15 years ago. And it led to this group of people on the internet who believed that two different dimensions that were very similar to one another intersected, and the way that we were able to identify it was that Nelson Mandela in this universe is still alive up until a few years ago. Some other examples are the Berenstain Bears. Do you remember the Berenstain Bears from when you were a kid or your kids were children, were young?
I remember the term. I don't remember
it was a series of kids' books that I'll admit I recall being spelled E-I-N at the end, Berenstain Bears. But now, if you go and find any of their books on the shelf, if you go and find the authors of the books, they're actually the Berenstain Bears, A-I-N, which is another example, a lot of people say, of the Mandela effect, of how our universes are intersecting, and there's, like, bits and pieces of different dimensions that get left behind. And Bob Lazar is another one of these kooky examples, where a lot of people recall him being killed or committing suicide under suspicious circumstances years ago, and now all of a sudden he's back in the spotlight again, which a lot of people think is a result of the interest in ATIP and Luis Elizondo and all that stuff. It's really hard to find... This is the problem with conspiracy theories, is that if you go deep enough, they all intersect, and the problem with that is that 99% of them are insane, lunatic bullshit. So, if you go too far past the surface of a lot of these theories, you connect them to insane bullshit, which kind of makes them all insane bullshit, right?
Right.
But every once in a while, there's some truth that you know, seeps out.
So is there an art to being a steward of one of these things? It's to not get too far into it, so you're constantly stirring the pot in a superficial way and not allowing it. But it doesn't go like that.
I would argue that that's the way I try to approach it. There are other guys, like the guy who runs theblackvault.com. His name escapes me right now.
What is
that?
What is the Black Vault? What is theblackvault.com?
The Black Vault is... So this guy, for years now, has just been submitting... He's been inundating, I would argue, the government with Freedom of Information requests pertaining to everything from Bigfoot and UFOs to just classified operations in Iran and things of that nature. And then every time he does get documents declassified through his efforts, he hosts them on his website, The Black Vault, which, for instance, recently there was a bunch of news about the FBI releasing their Bigfoot files, which there was nothing in them. But if you had been on the Black Vault, like, those files had actually been declassified 10 years prior and had already been hosted on that website. The FBI only recently hosted them on their own page. That was the only difference.
No,
but it's a great place to go and find declassified documents pertaining to whatever you might be interested in, you know? Yeah. The problem with being that deep in the culture is that I got to remember the name of the guy who runs the Black Vault. I got to Google it now because I feel bad that I'm talking about him and can't remember his name.
Well, especially with your, you know, wannabe Batman background, you ought to
you know,
be.
You
ought
to be.
You ought to be.
Well, not
given
only that,
your
but, like,
lineage.
I have been on his show.
Oh, shit!
As you know, I really ought to remember.
You think? Yeah, the Almarine Radio guy. I've been on that show all kinds of
times.
Well,
see, I always remember your name. That's all that really matters.
What?
Right?
What's that guy's name?
I'm going to look up his name while I go on. But the problem is that because he's a known quantity in the UFO investigation community, these guys are ruthless, man. You think the veteran community eats its own? UFO investigators, they enjoy nothing more than to tear each other apart in public settings. I don't know why. But they like to pick teams, and they like to just eviscerate one another. Mike Greenwald Jr. is his name.
Okay.
I think it's Mike Greenwald Jr. John Greenwald Jr., excuse me. John Greenwald Jr. So he was one of the first guys that said that Luis Elizondo, which for anybody following the Pentagon's recent UFO investigative program, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, there's a number of things that they call it, the Pentagon is claiming that Luis Elizondo never had anything to do with this program, which is kind of the basis of that new show on the History Channel with Tom DeLonge and Luis Elizondo. It's the basis of this To the Stars Academy. All this new UFO information has been coming through Luis Elizondo, and the Pentagon's now saying he never had anything to do with any investigation into UFOs at all. John Greenwald Jr. was one of the first guys to make that assertion, and as a result, the UFO community is kind of like folded in onto itself and started choosing sides. So they're all at war with one another. The only way you can avoid that is by keeping everything at arm's length, you know, and that's kind of what I try to do. I don't try to become a UFO guy. I'm just interested in it. When I'm off the clock, you know, I'll go on some weird subreddits. I'll watch some cool YouTube videos. But I try my best not to be a UFO journalist because it's hard to be a UFO journalist without having a dog in the fight. And I think if you have a dog in the fight, then you start fighting for your side as opposed to what must be true, and that's the problem. I really don't buy into this idea that there's 13 alien races exploring Earth right now that the government knows. I don't buy into the idea that we're reverse engineering alien technology. I do now, however, believe that something is going on in our airspace, whether it's from Earth or elsewhere, that we really don't quite have a handle on, and I think that the Pentagon's concerned about that, and that's interesting.
Well, that's interesting. Now, if you were going to give us a piece of equipment, one piece of equipment that you would say, okay, look, if you're going to be a true survivalist, right?
Ooh, a true survivalist.
A true survivalist, all right? And we're going to talk about the day after, all right? The one thing that you have to start with is?
A knife, a good quality knife. You know, and when I say a good quality knife, that's a loaded thing.
Yeah, what do you mean?
I make knives, so I'm a bit of a knife snob, right?
Right.
But there are guys out there that are far bigger knife snobs than me because, you know, like anything on the internet, you'll find those forums where they say, if you don't spend $1,000 on something, it's not worth having.
Yeah.
Right?
Come on.
The thing about a knife is that it's a sharp piece of metal, man. That's all a knife is. A knife just needs to be able to maintain an edge and stay pretty strong. And the reason why that's difficult is because the makeup of a knife is really what dictates how well it'll maintain that edge and how resilient the blade's going to be. If there's a lot of carbon in the steel, for instance, it will hold an edge really, really well. It'll stay extremely sharp, but the blade becomes brittle. So under abuse, the blade might break on you or at least chip, you know?
What impact do you think that extraterrestrial activity on Earth would have on the composition of metals? Do you think metal would withstand such an invasion, or do you think it would be compromised?
Well, that's a great question, because, I mean, like, that's what you hear about with the Roswell crash, quote-unquote, right, is that the metal that they found was, like, a weird tinfoil-type material that moved in a liquid way and was so resilient that it would always bounce back from whatever you did to it. You could crumple it up into a ball, lay it on a table, and it would flatten itself back out, right? You would have to assume that if a species had the ability to either A, master faster-than-light travel, or B, travel huge interstellar distances, or C, both, they would have to have some pretty impressive technology, including, I would imagine, metal alloys, right?
Right.
Speed means friction. Friction means heat, which means that you'd have to have material that could absorb a great deal of heat, unless
if you're going to go such a far distance.
Yeah, unless, of course, we're talking about technology offsetting that. Like, if you're using, some people say that it's a gravity drive using electromagnetic propulsion. That Star Trek is a good example of this. They create a warp bubble around their ships, so the ship itself is not actually interacting with the space it travels through. It's encapsulated within this bubble that's actually moving. If it was something like that, then I suppose you don't have to worry about friction surfaces, like when they're flying around here on Earth. But physics as we understand it, if you don't have a warp bubble, if you move at hypersonic speeds, you're going to create a ton of heat, you know? If you move at supersonic speeds, you'll create a ton of heat, but hypersonic especially. And if you ever want an example of that, go on YouTube and search for a view out the space shuttle window during reentry. And what you'll see is not only like an orange haze, which is actually the heat of the air around the space shuttle climbing up to like 3,000 degrees Celsius, but you'll also see what looks like water droplets on the outside of the space shuttle window. That's not water. It's actually melted metal. It's bits and pieces of the heat shield melting and moving like water droplets against the windows of the space shuttle. So when we're talking about heat of that magnitude, they must have some pretty incredible alloys. So maybe you don't have to worry about the carbon level in your steel anymore if aliens show up. But if you need that one knife for survival, honestly, man, you could get some crazy expensive thing. Get a good, thick 1095 fixed blade knife that's full tang. The blade needs to go all the way to the end of the handle. If it's 1095 steel, it's going to be pretty resilient, but you're going to have to sharpen it from time to time. That's just the trade-off you get.
How long and how thick should the blade be?
In my opinion,
because this is what we're going to build, right? You know, like, we're going to use this to build the fort that the postman's going to come to.
Now, if you're using this knife for a lot of things, for general purpose survival,
yeah,
a 12 or 13 inch knife is a good way to go, because you're going to want to be able to hack and chop.
Right.
Right. So you'll want kind of a full body blade and something that's a little bit longer so you have leverage, right? I named the knife Susan. I name a lot of my knives. Wow. I used a 13-inch, effectively just a plain old buck knife in Africa, building half a fucking Camp War Turtle when we were deployed out there. Because that one knife worked as a hammer, it worked as an axe, it was a hatchet, you know, it was whatever I needed it to be. But if you want to use a knife to clean animals, for instance, you're going to probably want a different knife than you'll want to chop wood, right? So if you want one knife that you can do everything with, you're going to have to make some compromises, right? But I think a 12 or 13-inch knife for a guy like you or me would probably be good. But you're going to want to base your knife on you, right? If you're a smaller framed person, if you're a lady or, just a guy who only weighs 130 pounds and, you know, you're 5'4" instead of 6' like I am, you're going to want to carry a different knife because you're going to handle your knife differently than, say, I would, right? So it's really all about what works for you, but that's what everything's about. But if you need one piece of gear, my first recommendation is a good quality survival knife, and not just that, but also the means to sharpen it. And I don't just mean that you got to go buy a fancy whetstone and use a friggin' protractor. I know that's what knife snobs want you to do. It's what I do with my personal knives. But honestly, you can just buy a regular plain old knife sharpener, a good quality 1095 steel knife, and as long as you take good care of your gear, it's going to last you a lifetime.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions of things I've seen on your website. One, speaking of HIT, the HIT case, the ultimate protection for your phone.
I didn't write this one, so I'm going to be speaking only from secondhand hearsay.
Got it.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But this is a good example of a phone for photographers. Like, let's say we're talking about you want to go out and get pictures of UFOs. Right. The HIT case is a good one. Nick Betts, the guy who wrote the article, is a professional photographer. It's the case that he uses because not only will it protect the lens of your phone, but you can use secondary lenses as well. You know, so if you use your phone, which nowadays you really can use your phone for all kinds of legit professional photography. The HIT case is probably your best bet on the market right now.
How do you attach? I'm looking at a picture that shows a secondary lens on the phone, does it just fit over the lens that's in the phone? Is that how this works?
Yes. Exactly. So it works in conjunction with the lens that's in the phone. So, like, the newer iPhones have pretty good zoom capabilities, right? But you can really zoom or go wider angle, things like that. Now, there are a lot of things out there that you can buy, like photo and video accessories for your iPhone. Right. I've got a bunch of them because I do a lot of filming, so mine are mostly video-centric. But, man, you'd be amazed the stuff that you can pull off. If you ever go to the loadoutroom.com or go to the YouTube channel for the Loadout Room, and you'll see lots of videos from both me and other contributors, and all of them are just filmed with our phones. We live in an amazing era,
right,
where you can get 1080p. I do use an external microphone. The microphones on your iPhone standard tend not to be all that good. I couldn't speak to Android. But, man, you'd be amazed the stuff photographically that you can pull off with phones these days. It's incredible.
All right, next one, and I knew this was you. Give me an evaluation of, because if we're starting with a knife, right, in the post-apocalypse era, okay, shortly thereafter we need to get a jetpack, all right?
Absolutely.
Give me a no shit evaluation. Are jetpacks anything more than somebody tethered in a Disneyland event now, or are they legit? Are we getting to the point where you're going to see people use jetpacks as a legitimate way to move around the post-apocalyptic world?
I would say right now we're at a place where jetpacks are about as effective as exoskeletons, exosuits, which is that they're not very, but they will be, I think, within decades. It's not going to be years, it'll be decades. The one jetpack that's featured on the Loadout Room right now is actually made by a former British Royal Marine. I'm trying to remember what the hell his name is. I think it's Richard Browning. He's a former Royal Marine who got out, isn't a mechanical engineer or anything, but just thought this idea was really cool, and he wanted to make like an Iron Man-style jet propulsion system. Originally, it was a backpack and like boosters on his legs. He realized quickly that that wasn't going to work because your legs kind of move willy-nilly. So instead, it's a jetpack and boosters on your hands. And this is back in the news a lot lately because Adam Savage, who used to host Mythbusters with Jamie Hyneman, has a new show coming out where he's building as close to a functional Iron Man suit as he can. And this is actually the jetpack that his design has incorporated. I would say that this jetpack is functional. In a way that most previous jetpacks haven't been. You know how, like, the one in the old James Bond movies and stuff? These jetpacks work, but we're talking about, like, 30 to 60 seconds of propulsion. You can't go very far, very high, or very fast. And then you need to land, or else it's going to burn out and you're going to fall down.
Yeah, but on the upside, it doesn't fuck up your hair.
Yeah, that's true. The problem with jetpacks in a combat environment is that you, A, have got to have the propulsion coming out of your body somewhere, which is pretty hard to do without burning the shit out of yourself. For instance, in Richard Browning's case, he's got the propulsion coming out of boosters on either side of his hands. His hands are enclosed within protective cases to protect them from the heat. That doesn't make you a very effective guy in combat if you can't use your hands.
Now, that's the booster?
Those are the boosters. He's
okay,
got
what about
boosters.
The pack itself?
Now, the backpack holds engines, and I think the backpack might provide some propulsion as well, but it also holds the fuel.
Right.
And the fuel is the real limiting factor when it comes to these jetpacks.
So, do you think as we develop peaceful civil nuclear energy, that maybe the flux capacitor is a power source for something like this?
We've tried using nuclear propulsion for aircraft and for weapons platforms before. Russia is actively, right now, trying to develop nuclear propulsion for a missile program.
And
it doesn't work very well. The problem is A, nuclear propulsion is very heavy. B, it tends to spew radiation, which isn't very good for the user or anyone under you.
No, because we need to live in the post-apocalyptic world.
Absolutely.
We don't want it to be a one-way flight. We'd like it to be multiple iterations.
Now, I don't want to say that we'll never come to a point where nuclear propulsion works, because I think it really could, in theory, work. You know, we were experimenting with it in the 1950s. Russia's nuclear propulsion missile does not work currently, but they are still working on it. I'm sure eventually you could get it to work. I don't know, however, that it's worth it. The fuel that you would need to use is so expensive. The potential fallout is a lot more significant than if you've got something running on diesel or even something more exotic. I don't think nuclear propulsion is the answer right now, but honestly, who knows what the answer will be? Because the same problem with exosuits is the same problem with jetpacks, and that is finding some way to keep these things powered. You know, we could make pretty effective exosuits right now if you could leave them plugged in. The problem is making a suit that's reliable, that's effective, that has a long enough battery half-life to be useful in some way in combat. You have the same problem with a jetpack. If you've got, I mean, this is a problem that flamethrower units have had to deal with, you know, in history already. But if you've got your fuel source on your back, that makes for a pretty big target, right? If it also has a huge effect on how much weight you can carry into the fight, right?
Man, so look, here I wanted you. God, get me to yes already. So, emails like this.
I think
so
we're Mac, still 50 years from yes.
Jetpacks as part of the assault element at Area 51, a no-go? I'm thinking it's a no-go, boys.
Well, I think actually that's probably your best-case scenario to use these jetpacks for something. Because in Area 51, we're not talking about trying to execute an armed assault with a plan. We're talking about throwing a bunch of meat at a fence, right? Yeah, put some dudes on jetpacks, drop them to missiles, that doesn't matter. Light the fuse, let them go. If the plan is to just raid this place to get in, and a lot of people are going to die anyway, yeah, man, strap a bunch of model rocket engines to your roller skates. It'll work. I don't know how effective you'll be after, but I do think it'll get some meat on target.
You might be scraped and battered beyond recognition, but...
Exactly.
Well, I'll just tell you, I mean, I did see The Rocketeer. It worked for him.
Oh, I love that movie.
That was awesome.
I love that movie.
That was a great movie. Oh, my God. It was. I watched that thing with my kids, man. It was like The Rocketeer. You know, I watch that any day.
The Rocketeer answered that age-old question of what if your superpower was flight, but that was it? Like, what good are you when you get there? Like, he would fly his way to, like, the blimp that the final battle's on, but then he's just kind of like, hopefully he's better at fist fighting than these guys.
Right. But you know? The funny parts are when he's, like, out of control in the suit, and he's, like, flying through cornfields and shit like that.
And this is exactly why you're not going to see flying cars. It's not that we lack the technology to build flying cars, it's that people lack the intellect to fly flying cars.
Yeah,
you think your insurance rates are high right now on your Toyota Corolla?
Can you imagine you were like taking a shortcut and you like dove into somebody's house?
Imagine that 16-year-old that was looking at their phone when they rear-ended you, doing 600 miles per hour above a school. You know, this is not this is not going to happen.
Hitting the Sears Tower in Chicago.
Exactly.
That's not, let alone the terrorist applications for it.
Oh, my God, right? I mean, think about, already box trucks and things like that have become, you know, a tool of choice for terrorists. Just imagine if you take that same box truck and add an afterburner. That's not a good idea.
Let's not say we did. Okay, what about, is there anything new going on at the loadout room that we should know about? What's taking your time there?
Is the first episode of a new series that I'm working on called How to Survive Anything that I'm pretty pumped about. The idea is pretty simple. It's every day, maybe not every day, 5 days a week, give or take, I'm going to be releasing one small tip, trick, survival skill, either from me or from special operations veterans that I work with, from government agencies, from guys who specialize in survival. One guy that works for us, Kubi Brown, he's not a veteran, but he's a wilderness survival expert who teaches survival courses out in Montana.
Okay.
So every day it'll be like a short thing that you can pick up easily that's just a good thing to have in your mental toolbox for survival. Tomorrow will be the first episode. Some of the things we're going to be talking about this week are how to signal SOS, which for a guy like you, Mac, is second nature. But if you aren't Mac and you don't know how to signal SOS, you can do it, you know, with sound. You can do it with light. You can do it with a signal mirror. SOS doesn't actually stand for anything, despite what your grandfather may have told you. But it is an
save
international...
Save.
I'm sorry?
Save, oh, save.
Save, oh, save, save our souls, save our ship. These are all wives' tales. SOS is actually just three letters that work well as an international distress signal. It doesn't actually stand for anything.
Save our shit?
Save our shit, yeah. But But so, you know, another one will be how long you need to boil water in order to make it potable. That's another one we're talking about this week. But they're not all necessarily hard skills. Some of them are soft skills, like combating normalcy bias or taking a step back and calming down in an emergency situation and things that you can do to help get a grip, you know. So it'll be a daily series for the most part where we're just going to be shooting out short, easy-to-digest tips that over the course of time, you know, you scoop them up here and there, you know, whenever you've got time, and you'll end up developing a pretty well-rounded base of things that you can do to survive in a bad situation. Wow. I'm excited about it. I don't know what kind of
response. So the object is survivalist? It's what is the object of this?
The idea really is that it should be something that anyone can use. You know, not necessarily every tip is going to pertain to every person. If you live in New York City, for instance, being able to boil water is actually just as important to you as it is for others, because if the water you get out of your sink is no longer considered potable and won't be for a long time, you still need to boil your water or find some other water filtration method to make it potable, right?
Right.
But some of the skill sets maybe won't pertain to everybody until you find yourself in a certain set of circumstances, you know? If you live in New York City, you may not need to know how to build a fire as readily as others might need to know. But ultimately, the idea should be that just about anybody, and that's really my intent for the approach, is that this is not meant to be angled directly at your Marine Corps infantry guy who is already familiar with a lot of what we're talking about. I want it to be interesting for him. I want him to be able to pick up some new things. But I also want my mom to be able to Google, how do I signal SOS? And I want her to be able to find the video or the article. It'll be both. And understand quickly and easily just what it's about, you know. And so my goal is to create kind of a knowledge library that people can always come back to, or if you're Googling something in particular, you'll find, or every day you can just pick up a new tip, you know, that's good to throw in the old brand housing group. I don't know how well it'll be received. It's launching tomorrow. This is entirely my own invention. There's going to be some other things that come with it. I've got some surprises lined up, but really this is just, you know, you give me a website, I'm going to invent some shit to put on it. And this is my first big project with the loadout room. I'm excited about it.
Do they have it? Tell everybody where they go for it.
So you can find it every day on loadoutroom.com. You can also find it on YouTube. Our website on YouTube is The Loadout Room. Pretty easy to find. I highly recommend you checking it out. And please, by all means, feel free to comment on the site. Let me know, hey, man, you know, you talked too fast. I didn't understand it. That would not be a new criticism of me. Let me know if
I don't
you'd like
say
me
that.
To go more in depth.
He speaks in 8 font.
I do. I speak very quickly and too much. It's a project that I'm working on. It's a labor of love, and you guys are the reason I'm making it. So if you watch one of the videos and you think it's rad, please share it. Please say so in the comments below. And if you don't like it, if you think there's things that could be done better, I'm all ears. You know,
send me a personal email on that one. Anything you think is great, feel free to comment on the website. Anything you think sucks, send me a personal email. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm a moderator, so I can delete the ones after.
There you go. No comment appears unless approved. I don't think about anybody who hasn't learned that is stupid. All right. And how to write their own comments. All right. Anyway. All right. Alex, thanks for the visit.
Hey, man. It's been a real pleasure. Oh, before I go, I do want to say, make sure you swing by Popular Mechanics. I've got an article on Popular Mechanics right now about why the B-1B Lancer is such a badass plane. The more people click on these articles, the more articles like it, they'll let me write. I'm working on one right now about the Apollo 11 return trip that I'm really excited about. So make sure you swing by Popular Mechanics and click on anything with my name on it.
There you go. Alex Hollings, he's a dork, but he's also the editor of The Loadout Room, and you can find that at loadoutroom.com, along with a whole bunch of other interesting articles about knives, gear, survival things, and some other quirky stuff that you'll enjoy. It's very good. So, Alex, thanks for the visit.
Hey, thanks so much, man. I'll see you later.
There you have it. The one and only Hollings, Alex type. Here on a Monday. And that'll do it. Email, Max, shut your dog's yap. I can't. Colleen came home. What can I say? Joe activated as the security apparatus here. So let me just tell you this, the difference between my dogs. yesterday, so they're both out in front. Jack's still nervous because he has PTSD because he had an event with a lawnmower that he hasn't gotten over yet, which is okay. So Jack and Joe are out in front. After a while, Jack's like gets nervous and says, "I want to go inside." Joe, he's like, this is Saturday. And so Joe, he's out there and I'm raking, and then I drop the rake, right? Because I've got to pick stuff up. And when I dropped the rake, it hit Joe right in the head. And what did he do? He took off running, ran in a circle. Then he looked at me like, "What just happened?" And I said, "I don't know what happened, man. You want get over here? We got to put leaves in the trash can." And Joe comes right back. Jack, he would have been under the bed at that. And then yesterday, the whole time I snaked the sewer line, Joe right there watching the whole thing. "What are we doing now, boss?" Like, "We're over here, bro." Yeah. Jack, he's on it, man. No, Jack's in the house. Joe, he's a man's best friend, man. That'll do it on a Monday. If you're just tuning in, you can hear all about my weekend. Actually, the show's moderately humorous today. In addition to, I don't like the president says, if you want to leave America, leave it. I don't like those. I don't like that. Find another way to throw fuel on the fire, you know, that those four congresswomen are. But, you know, clearly, the president learned something during his election. And I think he came to a crossroads after they released that audio, and everybody in a meeting said that he should quit. And it was, what's that dude's name? Steve what? What's his name? He's Steve Bannon looked at him and said, "Double down on it. Double down on it. You're going to win." And I think the president learned the lesson. Like, don't run from those stances. I don't like this one, though, just so you know, in case anybody cares. Yeah, I don't like... Yeah, I don't care for it. Leave the country if you don't love it. Yeah, again, America, love it or leave it. I just don't care for it. But again, in my opinion, what he's trying to do is he's trying to make them the poster child for the Democratic Party. And that's what he'll run against. So... I've seen him do this often enough that he just doesn't plainly misspeak when he does this. He understands better than most of us what he gets out of this. And, I mean, his election, his improbable election, as I said, I just don't particularly care for America, love or leave it. What does make us different, if we're talking about the real world, is our respect for minority parties, for minority opinion, for dissent. And that's what makes America different from every other place on the planet. Most every other place. There's a few Western democracies that are very much like us, but the rest of the world, the protected right of the opposition is truly Jeffersonian and what makes us unique. All right, with that said, have a great day. Tomorrow, you're going to hear an interview that I do with Mark Cancian. And Mark came on to talk about something that he wrote for the Center for the Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. He works for them. Okay. Tell me how this ends. Military advice, comma, strategic goals, comma, and the forever war in Afghanistan. And so in the discussion, which we recorded on Friday, you're going to hear us talk about both Afghanistan and Iraq, how those things started, what didn't happen, you know, what do leaders need to keep us from doing these kind of stupid things. So don't miss that. It's pretty good. Pretty good. He's a smart guy. Former infantry and artillery officer. Have a great day. On a, what's today, Monday? All Marine Radio is over and out.